Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to a wonderful pre-Rosh Hashanah show. We have three excellent segments for you today. First up, Malka Fleischer coming in right now. I'm excited to have her on the show. And we're going to talk about getting ready for Rosh Hashanah, dealing with Corona, and eating burgers while the Abraham Accords were taking place in Washington. But some people here in Israel and Ashkelon and Ashdod suffered because Hamas doesn't want that kind of peace. We're also going to be talking with Rabbi Rav Mike Foyer about Rosh Hashanah meditations, considerations, and also my question, which is, why is Ishmael featured so prominently in the Rosh Hashanah liturgy? Maybe that's part of the Abraham Accords. We'll get to that. And then, right before the Abraham Accords, I spoke with a foreign policy expert and think tank extraordinaire man, Matthew Brodsky, about what's the Washington scoop, what's behind it, and an interesting take on what Emirati sovereignty means in relationship to Israel. You'll have to stay tuned to understand what I'm talking about. So without further ado, here's Malka Fleischer. Malka, shalom,
hey,
and welcome to the show.
Last show before Rosh Hashanah.
That's right. Last show before the Rosh Hashanah.
Last year of 5780. Tashop. I did not shop enough.
That's
whatever.
Right. Tashop is the...
Oh, with all these lockdowns and all this stuff. I couldn't Tashop all the way.
That's right. And there's so much waiting. There's so much stuff waiting for you in the Brooklyn office.
In the next year. In Hebron's
Brooklyn office.
I know, my face cream.
I haven't been into that Hebron Brooklyn office in so long. And it's like this, like, it's like from Hebron, which is like the edge of Jewish settlement in Judea and Samaria, to like Brooklyn, which is the old Altaheim.
Right, you got amazing savings.
You got the delicious deli sandwich.
Bologna sandwiches.
When was the last time I had a great salami and bologna sandwich? I've told you once I told you that like I used to like bologna when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And you're like, you're still holding on to
my
that.
My bologna has a first name.
The bologna sandwich. That's true. We used to have it when I was
in a... when you were a kid? Ishai, don't lie to the listeners.
They don't even make bologna anymore.
I don't think they do make bologna.
They make salami, but they don't even say the word.
Before they stopped making bologna, which was just not that long ago, I have seen you eat a bologna sandwich myself with my own eyes.
I don't think so. I think that you say...
I think
you often
Yosef
say to
from
me,
Brooklyn... took us to a deli one time when Leah Batzion was very, very little. And I think you got a bologna sandwich.
I think you might be right. But I think you may be confusing because you a lot of times say that I'm full of bologna. And so you may be confused about that.
They still do make bologna.
Speaking of being full of bologna, yesterday our faces were filled with delicious...
Not bologna,
but delicious burger bar burgers, which we ordered for the occasion of the Abraham Accords signing ceremony that was featured prominently on our television.
Because nothing says peace like a good burger.
That's right.
And
there was a triumvirate.
I got you an onion rings.
There was a triumvirate of great things, which is there was the big thing on TV, which we wanted the kids to see, the Abraham Accords. And then there was burgers, and it was also your mother's yard sale.
That's right.
So those three things came together, and it was really pretty
neat. She would have been happy.
Oh, she certainly would have been happy. I really enjoyed the Accords ceremony, except the next day. I'll tell you, the word peace, like, a little bit gets underneath my skin. I prefer...
Well, it's been misused for a long time,
right?
So you have, like, PTSD.
I have PTSD.
I have PTSD.
What I prefer is when they say, I like Abraham Accords, I like bilateral, relations and diplomatic ties, established
normalization.
But peace, shalom, salam. I hear that stuff, and they sprawl it all over the papers. Peace, shalom, salam. It's a little. Oh, I don't have a good word for it, but like, I have a bad word for it. Okay, but please help me. You'll understand what I mean. But it's like effeminate a little bit. It's like
a bad word for that.
Okay, but you know what I mean. There's something about it
it's
which
too
is
touchy feely for you.
It's too touchy feely. That's the word I'm looking for. It's too...
Well,
it's
why don't you give the rest of us our moment for a second?
I'm cool. I'm cool with that. And if you need the peace talk,
what do you mean need? Some people feel that way. And if you go to social media right now,
yeah,
Like, you have your analysts, your cold analysts, who are talking about the normalization. And then you have your people, like Fanny over there in UAE, who's, like, talking about the children of Israel and the land of Israel and stuff like that. And that the, that he if people want to accuse him of being a Zionist because he believes that the Jewish people have a right to their land, then yes, he's a Zionist. There are people who are feeling very touchy-feely about it all.
I am also feeling touchy-ish feeling.
Although I did not like the Palestinian state talk at the normalization signing.
It was barely.
It just, you notice there was no clapping.
Yeah, and honestly, it was a barely. Really, it was.
But aside from that, there was. It seemed like there was a lot of like high energy, good feelings.
Yes.
There was no handshaking, but that was a Corona thing.
Yeah, there was a Corona thing. I just, and you know what they should have done? Not the leaders. Like,
they should have done.
We had our prime minister, and there was the president of the United States, but they sent their two
foreign ministers.
Foreign ministers,
which is interesting, and I wonder about that.
I think that
why didn't we send our foreign minister?
They're trying to like take it easy a little bit. They're really stepping into something for us. It's like,
yeah, plus we want that photo op, right? BB like wants to be in that picture.
Right. And so does Trump. But by the way, I just want to tell you, here's a tweet that I sent out. You and I have had some great tweets in the last few days. I sent out one out that says, "I love the name Abraham Accords. It's a wonderfully contextualizing term which stresses that the Jews are ancient people, indigenous to the Middle East. This is opposed to the propaganda term occupation, which promotes that the lie that Jews are foreigners in Judea." Okay, so I also feel very strongly about the whole thing. I feel that this is a big deal, and I am moved by it. I just don't like I guess you're right. You said it. I just don't like the overly like huggy feely.
Why?
I'll tell you why. Because I think that in the Middle East, being touchy feely is just not the way that people respect you. It's not through peace, it's through strength, and therefore doing touchy-feely shows that you need and want and feel touchy-feely instead of being like, good, now we can fight Iran, have better trade, push back on forces that are regressive forces. And speaking of regressive forces, true to character, one cannot expect any less from them. True to character, and I salute them, because I salute evil when it does its thing.
Okay.
Hamas fired rockets.
I'll salute them.
I salute anybody who does his thing all the way. Just like when I say salute, I'm more like respect, not like, but I honor the full on evil that is Hamas.
Right.
I take them seriously, and I say, touche, okay? And I say, the reason I like to take evil seriously is because I say, when they do something like that, take it seriously, and then smash them 10 times hard. And Malka, this is my, the new coming year is Tuf Shin Pei, Aleph.
Aleph.
Right?
Yeah.
Which was, it was to shop last
That's
year.
That's what it sounds like.
To shop, right? No, but yeah. I'll tell you, I came up with an acronym. Tie Shnat PLF. It should be a year of a thousandfold.
That's cool.
PLF.
You know, that reminds me of some of the Rosh Hashanah Simanim that I prepared. Or I haven't prepared. I'm a little behind my game this year. I think with all the coronavirus shutdowning.
Yeah.
That I'm like.
Yeah.
The first time we went into coronavirus shutdown, I was basically on my phone for like 4 days consecutively. Just like with my eyes glazed over and not even knowing how to deal with anything. And I think that there's a little bit of that happening to me right now, but much less.
Yeah.
But still a little bit, because here in Israel, we're definitely getting what they were talking about, that second wave.
Second wave.
And the second wave is bigger than the first wave.
The second wave is like two times bigger.
And we know a lot of people.
My buddy Yehuda. From Im Tirtzu called me today, and he's like, I got Corona.
It's bad.
And I'm not feeling good too. He's the first guy to also hear that has told me that he's not feeling well.
We know a lot of people who are in a lockdown. We also know some people who have coronavirus, but have zero symptoms.
Right.
And the only reason they know is because they went through some kind of like obligatory testing for various reasons.
Right.
And that's the only reason that they even know that they have coronavirus. That's, by the way, happening a lot here in Israel, that people feel fine, but because they were in close contact with a person who had coronavirus, who may also have felt fine, by the way, then they are obligated to get a coronavirus test. And then it turns out that they're positive. And they basically sit in their house for 2 weeks.
Right.
And they feel fine. I think there might be some post, like, 2 weeks testing or whatever to make sure you don't have it anymore. But
I do want you
but
to
there's,
know
like,
that
so many people, including many, many children,
yes.
who are in isolation.
The power of the Yishai Fleischer show.
It was brought to bear?
It was brought to bear last week.
Oh, how so?
When I asked listeners to pray for my good friend Arthur's well-being, he has since gone a good way forward in recovery. That's right.
Kol hakavod, Yishai Fleischer show listeners.
That's right. When I say the power, I mean to say the power of us getting together and asking the Lord God Almighty to help us heal.
That's wonderful. We should is really a time of prayer.
That's right. Now I'm pretty sure that you guys feel inside your heart that you have what to pray for, but you're having a hard
time.
How do I know you're having a hard time? Because I'm having a hard time. And like it's time and I'm looking forward to the calmness of Rosh Hashanah to help us pray.
Because
we gotta pray just to make it today.
Well, Rosh Hashanah is going to be calm. Part of the reason it's going to be calm is because we're all going to be so confused, basically, about how's the right way to operate. I saw today, by the way, what are those diagrams where it's like, do you like pink? Yes, arrow over here. No, arrow over there. And then it takes you on like a journey and then you get to a final answer.
Oh, I thought that's like something you know, the name of that
Not
term.
Venn diagram, but that's what wants to come into my head.
No, the flow chart.
A flow chart.
Yeah.
I saw a flow chart of how you're supposed to respond to coronavirus because so many people are confused about at what point they are obligated to either get in touch with authorities or to go into quarantine or to get a coronavirus test, that they have to they're starting to map it out in diagrams because it's so confusing. So there's another confusing thing, which is that Rosh Hashanah prayers are going to be happening, but very extremely different than normal. I wonder if it's going to be the case in the United States.
Well, first thing, it's Shabbat, so therefore we don't blow shofar on the first day.
Right, you don't blow shofar, but that's not even the big thing.
Yeah.
The big thing is that if you're praying outdoors in an outdoor minyan, which is a new thing for this year, right? Because
a minyan is a prayer quorum.
A prayer quorum of men primarily, but also women can join in. You can have 20 people, but those 20 people have to be 2 meters apart. And each group of 20 people has to be marked off with a rope or a tape. And an empty chair has to be placed between participants who do not live in the same household. So you can have 20 people, but you have to have 40 chairs. Is that right?
No.
Not necessarily.
No. You have to have 10 chairs, 20 people. Oh,
no, those people want to sit down.
What?
Those 20 people all want to have a chair.
And then 10 more.
You need 10 extra at least.
Well, not necessarily. Well, yeah,
depending on the number of rows.
Depends on rows and also
and how much space you have. And you need people to be 2 meters apart if they are not from the same household. So you also need a certain amount of space.
Yeah. It's a balagan.
This should be, by the way, like a sixth grade, seventh grade math question.
Right. This is exactly right. When I read that, I thought to myself, if a train leaves Chicago at 73 kilometers an hour and another one leaves New York at 75 kilometers an hour, they're both heading on one rail towards one another. At which point will they meet and you know, when?
I want to say, if you have 20 praying people, 20 praying men on Rosh Hashanah, 3 of them are related and you need to have no less than 4 rows. What shape prayer zone and what is the circumference of that prayer zone?
Maka, do you already have your menu? You talked about the venue, but what about your menu?
Right. So I do have a menu. I'm going to be amending the menu because I realized that it was too ambitious for this year. But I have already made my brisket. The brisket, actually, it's such a Jewish food, right? If you go, if you type into Google or to like Pinterest or to allrecipes.com or whatever all the websites you like, if you type in like Jewish food or Jewish holiday food or something like that, invariably brisket will come up. And by the way, this is probably the like Ashkenormativity or whatever that the Mizrahim are always talking about.
I've not heard that term.
You have certain like activists for Mizrahi Jews who are upset that like people always perceive Jewish as Ashkenazi, but that's not necessarily true. And this is like one of those moments. You're just like, brisket? How is brisket like the food that everybody considers to be a Jewish food? But it took me like 17 years of marriage to get up the courage to make a brisket. And I really made it for the first time on Pesach when we also had our first bidud. So in the merit of coronavirus, that is like one good thing that came out of coronavirus.
I am
rich. Not much good has come out, but brisket did. Well,
if you listen to the next quarter with Rabbi Mike Foyer, he really says something so beautiful, which is that this change in situation is an invitation. Invitation to look inward, invitation to pray, really. Like a lot of times, like we go to Yerushalayim usually for Rosh Hashanah, and I'm going to really miss it this year. But at the same time, it's like, here's an opportunity to like look inward and to draw energies from within and from within the family unit and other things to really...
So wait, but how does that have to do with my brisket?
That there are good things that come out of... Right. And clearly... Your brisket is one of those.
Right. My brisket is one of the few, you know, it's the silver lining, if you will.
Yeah.
So I made a brisket. I also, there's this website called Gush Gourmet. There's a lady who lives in Neve Daniel there. She's a caterer and she has her own blog and she posts recipes. One of her famous recipes is for onion chicken.
Mm.
So we're going to have like an oniony chicken also. I drizzled some honey on there.
What about the Moroccan lady that you watch? The Israeli Moroccan lady?
There's this fantastic Moroccan lady. I don't remember her name. It's like Sima or something like that. And she's so cool. But she actually makes like pretty complicated recipes, but she does everything in the most like Amami Israeli way ever, using like plastic single-use cups and single-use spoons and stuff like that. Everything is like not fancy, but she ends up making beautiful and delicious food. And she talks about how, you know, she sprinkles some sesame seeds on. She's like, it's healthy. She's just really cool. But it's all her recipes are in video form, so I can never I never sit down and write it all down.
Oh,
but I like to watch her. She's on YouTube.
Did you check the comments?
I checked the comments.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, Malka, so we covered
but
Rosh Hashanah.
I have some news. We didn't cover it because I told you that I have some new simanim for this year.
New, what are simanim again?
Now, there are certain foods that you're supposed to eat that you are traditionally eating on Rosh Hashanah, mm-hmm, that symbolize certain blessings that you are praying for in the coming year. Basically, what we understand about the process of Rosh Hashanah is that Hashem is making a lot of decisions about your upcoming year on Rosh Hashanah, mm-hmm, including how much money. And then, of course, you know, we're talking about who will live and who will die and what ways, right? Who by fire and who by water. These are the like famous scary prayers of Rosh Hashanah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really praying that Hashem will help us to have a beautiful and nice and happy year, and a year filled with all kinds of nice things, including like, you know, giving us a good judgment for Rosh Hashanah. But some people, these are customs, right? And some people have within their own homes the customs to add more simanim because it's not forbidden, right? You don't say like Hashem's name or anything like that. So you can add as many little symbolic foods as
you
want.
For example, a beet.
Yes.
In Hebrew is called selek.
Right.
So we say, you should be good looking like Tom Selleck driving that Ferrari in Magnum PI, for example.
Right.
That's, you know, that's an example of a siman. But generally, they're more like laid out. Or we'll say this is a date. May Hashem give us, you know, good dates this year.
Right.
All right.
For those of us who need.
What do you mean? We all need. I like to take you out on
a
date.
True. Yeah, we had that vegetarian cholent date.
That's right. That was
at
awesome.
Siftach.
That was awesome.
Which sounds like it was a horrible date.
No, but it was awesome.
But it was delicious, yeah. Actually.
So, but that's just an example of, so what are your new signs this year?
So, one of them I learned from, the Goldmans up in the Golan, and a shout out to Shmuel Goldman, who I miss, and he sent us pictures from like 5 years ago from the last time we spent a Rosh Hashanah together or something like that, which was just a million years ago. But we miss them very much. So he taught us this one, Petriot, which is mushrooms.
You know, I already said this on the next.
Oh, did you?
I said this thing.
That's
with,
really funny.
With a
shout out? That's yeah. amazing. Yeah. Wow. So I guess he's really part of
well,
Rosh Hashanah.
Go ahead. So you just say it for this half.
So I actually had a different thought on the word Petriot because he used to call it like patriots.
Oh,
right?
No.
That we should
I
be
talked
patriots.
About mushroom that you should have a lot
oh,
of.
Oh, they should mushroom. So he said that we should be patriots.
Right.
Right. But I said we should have a lot of Petronote. We should have a lot of good solutions
that's right.
for our problems. I also bought a vegetable called artichoke Yerushalmi, Jerusalem artichokes.
Right.
So, of course, that is a symbol that
our enemies should choke when they hear that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and is recognized by the whole world.
Right, when we fully rebuild Jerusalem.
The Jerusalem enemy choke.
Right. I also bought alfalfa sprouts. Because you see how you were talking about Tufshin Pei Aleph.
Right.
What did you call it? Tieshnat
Pi
Aleph. So building on that, alfalfa sprouts could be like Aleph Alfei something
Alephim,
good.
Alephim, right.
Yeah, Alephim.
Like myriads.
Myriads of blessings this
yeah,
year.
Amen. You know,
if you guys have some cool simanim, if you guys have
yes.
ideas of great... symbolic foods or symbolic things to do, hashtag symbolic foods, send it in to us and we would love to know. You can also tweet at us. We're at Twitter, Malka Fleischer and Ishai Fleischer. We would love to know about your symbolic foods, and we're also on Facebook.
Right. Send us your symbolic food ideas. They could be funny. They could be real. Hashtag symbolic foods. Hashtag simanim.
Hashtag Rosh Hashanah.
Hashtag Rosh Hashanah. Please send it over. That's very important. And it could be funny. And we will do them here at our simanim seder. I want to say to you, last week we asked for kitty cat advice.
Right.
For our new cat. I got a great email from Olivera. All right. In Novi Sad, Serbia, all right, who gave really serious advice, and she, a lot of people were talking about the scratching problem and the cutting of the nails and how to deal with it.
I went for it, by the way.
Yes, you did.
I used our nail clipper that our family uses on our nails, and I used it to clip the cat's nails.
You trimmed it.
Trimmed it. Well, okay, the only reason I was able to do it is because I remember when I was growing up, my parents would cut the nails of our dogs.
Right.
And I remembered that sometimes, you know, Isha, I don't know if you know, this might be a little bit of TMI for you, but there's actually a vein that goes up to a point in the nail.
Uh-huh.
And then it's like the white of the nail, you know,
yeah,
like
yeah,
us,
yeah, yeah.
like we have. If you cut that, they start to bleed.
Oh.
We had some bad scenes in our house in Texas when my parents would get it a little bit wrong. You have to use like a, what's it called? Styptic powder or whatever to
oh,
like,
no.
it's nasty and it's painful for the, anyway.
Oh no.
So with the cat, I was aware of this and I Googled it and I looked into it. Anyway, I cut the cat's nails and so far so good.
Well, Olivera.
Where there was no bleeding.
Olivera from Serbia gave advice about cutting and you did it.
I definitely got a lot of confidence and strengthening from that email.
That's right. Also,
on my cat care.
Also, Stephen from Texas talked about declawing the front claws,
right,
etc. And another one was from Vicky York, talked about her cats and how to deal with it. And good advice. So cat advice was greatly appreciated.
Yeah, you guys are the best.
For friends who wrote
your
from all over the world.
Your cats should all be healthy this year.
Amen. And at the same time, we're asking you for your excellent simanim. And if you have pictures,
yeah,
send it on down. Send it
I
on
also
down.
Want to see, I saw in a WhatsApp group of my town, somebody sent out pictures of the like amazing challah shapes that she made for Rosh Hashanah. Mm-hmm. Somebody made a shape of like a fish.
Oh man, you know, speaking of that, there's been this thing that's in my mind. I just want you to know. One time we were at Rabbi Shimshon Nadel's house.
Yeah.
And he's got this book about Shabbat and customs of Shabbat. Mm. And it's got all these like numbers of challahs according to Arizal stuff.
Like
and
how many
shapes
challahs
and 16 challahs and the little two little challahs and two medium challahs. All kinds of crazy wild stuff. You know, Judaism has got so many layers. Speaking of layers, we have a very layered show for you today with a lot of great stuff. Malka, you got us off right with a lot of strong positive energy. And it's not easy.
My pleasure.
It's not easy, Malka, to have positive energy right now. There's a lot of things that want to bring you down.
That's faux show.
Bring you down to Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And you do not want to go down there. You want to get back up right now and say, heck no, not going to be brought down by this darkness and this coronavirus, which is, you know, slipping in here like some kind of unstoppable rebel force. Okay. And we're not going to let it take over. We're going to push back on it. And we're going to push back on it. And we're going to be PLF a thousandfold, a myriad fold. We're going to just bounce out of this thing. And the thing that we have to do right now is to feel that lightning inside. You know, feel that lightning inside. Now, if anybody's ever been to like the weight room, Like sometimes when you're lifting weights, you're like you're getting crushed underneath this thing and you can't lift it. But if you can like muster up something from inside, a type of like energy, a type of like, it's a kind of anger, a kind of lightning that says no, and you just like push it out. And I think that that's what we have to have right now. We have to have that explosive energy and not let ourselves like be down. Yes, we have to be inside, and yes, we've got to be away farther from people. And yes, if I breathe through a mask one more day, I'm going to, I don't know what, you know what I mean? Because the oxygen,
our faces are sweating.
My beard gets full of sweat. I have to like, I can't deal with it. But with all that stuff, we just have to bounce out of this thing. And not that necessarily we're going to beat it immediately, but let's have that Rosh Hashanah this year. Let's have that amazing Rosh Hashanah. That's what I want to do. I want the kids to really see that in the face of adversity, we can do it. And I want Hashem to be like, look at my people. My people, by the way, are the Jewish people and also lovers of the Jewish people and people that are connected to us all over the world. So I want to thank you very much, Malka, for starting us off right. We have a great show with Rav Mike Foyer coming up and with Matt Brodsky. Talking about we're going to be talking about the Abraham Accords and all that jazz. So there's a lot of positive energy, and I want to wish you really, Malka, a Shana Tova.
Yeah, Shana Tova, Yishai.
And I'm sorry that you didn't get Tushap at Tushap is enough, but you should get Tufshin Pei Aleph, which is
Tushap. Oh, like that.
Yeah, I thought Tushapa. That's what I thought. Okay, I'm going to Shapa. All right, but that's what I originally thought. But then I'm like, that's not good enough. And it's going to be Tieshnat PLF. It's going to be a thousandfold year this year. Awesomer. That's right. Awesomeness. All right, folks.
Yishai, you should just be blessed in the new year, Yishai, to do great shows and meet great people and eat my brisket and be healthy. That's really the truth. And learn a lot of Torah and be in a good mood all the time.
God bless you, Malka. Thank you. And continue to have great health this year.
Amen.
And beauty and strength. And as we bless one another, let it be a blessing for everybody out there. Please write me an email with your simanim, with your signs for the Seder signs of the Rosh Hashanah. What are they called? Signs in English? The auspicious.
Yes.
Auspicious blessings, auspicious fruits. Send
hashtag
us your signs.
Auspicious.
Yeah, and you don't even have to spell it right because I won't know the difference, okay? So just hashtag auspicious.
Will.
That's right. Hashtag auspicious. And write me an email, yishai@yishaifleischer.com or yishai@thelandofisrael.com. The Land of Israel Network has many other great shows, and I urge you to check it out. In the meantime, stay tuned for Rav Mike Foyer, who's going to rock your face if you just let him, okay? Because he's going to be right now. It's Tashapa. He's going to be on right now. And after that, Matt Brodsky, a great show for you. Shana Tova Metukah, lots of love, lots of blessings from
Judea
and the land of blessings. Malka, say after me. Blessings from
blessings
the land.
Blessings from the land of blessings.
That's it. Blessings from the land of blessings. From Hebron, from Jerusalem and Judea, from Shiloh and Shechem. Shiloh and Shechem. And from Tel Aviv and from Eilat and from Yericho and from... And even the folks in Jenin, all right, or in what else, in Kfar Qasim, or wherever it is, All over the land, we're sending you our blessings. And even though we're disconnected physically, we're more and more connected emotionally, spiritually, and through the networks. All right, folks, stay tuned. More great stuff's on the way.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Ishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting really, really live from Judea and Jerusalem at the same time to the world. That's right. To the world, you're a part of it wherever you are. And this is the pre-Rosh Hashanah show, which means the pre-New Year show. And I want to disabuse you of what was that?
Sorry, that was a squeak.
Oh, my gosh. I want to disabuse you of one notion, everybody, which is that Rosh Hashanah is not the Jewish New Year. That's an incorrect phraseology. It's not the Jewish New Year. It's the New Year.
Kol Bayim Aharon.
That's right. It's the New Year, and we're all part of it. And I just want to tell you, Rav Mike, already people are saying hello from Germany, saying hello. And Simon Zelkin is saying good morning from Johannesburg, South Africa. Hello, Simon. Hello, our friends from Germany. So people are really talking from all over the world already. And that's exactly right, because this is, it's just like you said, Rav Mike Foyer, we're talking about a holiday that is for everybody, Jews and non-Jews alike. This is the day, I mean, of course, you have to be a believer, right? You got to believe that the God of Israel is the God of all people. By the way, I want to tell you, Rav Mike.
Well, that's true. You're probably getting in the New Year judgment whether you believe that or not. It just
that's right. That's right. I want to tell you, I have been enjoying, and probably more than most people, I've been enjoying your Heralds of Zion series. I have a feeling that I enjoy it more than a lot of people because it's just it's right up my alley. On
yeah, you got a lot of background there, and it's on a passionate connection.
Yeah, and it's just so many interesting things. And one of the things that you said on the show, which I thought was like a total eye opener to me, you know, it's about Abraham. I read this in a different book that it says, I'm trying to remember which book. It says the first time that we meet Abraham, the first words that we meet about Abraham in the same verses, go to the land of Israel.
Yep.
So the land of Israel and Abraham are totally connected. Now I remember where it was. It was in the Chalban. Totally connected things. But what you said on your show about Abraham is that Abraham, on the one hand, he represents the founder of the Jews. He's the first Jew. And at the same time, his very name means father of many nations, Av Hamon Goyim. So there's a tension between the universalist and the particularist in that. And that's, I think, Rosh Hashanah is another great example of that, where you have a new year, which is known as the Jewish New Year, but it is, and the Jews get together in prayer and they do their thing. And maybe the rest of the world is not commanded to do so, but at the same time, the world is being judged on this day, and I think it would behoove all of our friends around the world to feel the importance of Rosh Hashanah and take an extra, you know, maybe like a new time is being awakened right now, where the non-Jews of this world, the lovers of Israel, are saying, hey, this is Rosh Hashanah. We got to do something also in order to tip the balance of this world for good. What do you think about that?
Yeah, in many ways, you're correct. Rosh Hashanah and all Chag Tishrei, all these the holidays of this month, represent that tension between the particular and the universal. Because in many ways, we were given these days in trust. We give them in trust. Like you said, we know we have a calendar, we have the commandments of the Torah, we have a long tradition of how we access them, but they're not just about us, it's about the world. And that opens up not only an opportunity, but a responsibility for us to really to teach in the right way what these days can be. And the primary way to do that is by example, is by really accessing the transformative potential of these days and becoming the people that we're really meant to be. Once we do that, we will have an argument to be made that this is something that the whole world really could benefit from. Right? We're not the proselytizing religion that gets out there and tries to teach the world sort of in an activist sense about the truth as we understand it. We're more of the classic, you know, light to the nations, which is like, let's actually go deep into our particular tradition and allow it, do the work and allow it to make us who we could be. And then the world will see that there's a God and that this God doesn't just exist in the abstract, but has given us a Torah, and that Torah has the power to really unleash the potential which was built into creation from the beginning. So, I mean, yes, it's about us in our practices and our tradition and the Torah, which is given to us. But really, it's for the sake of all creation. That's why that phrase that I quoted before, Kol b'nei marom, that all the sort of creatures, all the act works of creation pass before God. And God's like a shepherd saying, yeah, this one, yeah, this one, that's one. Then no one goes unnoticed, which is beautiful and terrifying, which is another one of the tensions of this day.
And when within what you just said about there's also the tension between individualism and corporatism or collectivism.
Yeah.
And we're being judged individually. And yet it's not just like about like, are you going to be healthy, get the money and be able to raise your kids well? It's really about a global, is the world going to be judged favorably? And yeah. let's just pause for a second. I felt kind of harried today, so I jumped into the show kind of harried. And the reason I'm harried is because it's been very tumultuous days in the last few days. First is that we had yesterday at our house a kind of celebratory meal. It was my mother-in-law's Leah Bat Feiga and Mordechai's, my mother-in-law's yahrzeit. And for my mother-in-law's yahrzeit, there was also the Abraham Accords live on TV. So we ordered, and she was a big pro-Israel activist, so we ordered, this is very rare, we ordered burger bar for the whole family, the five burger combo. Okay, so we had the five burger combo with five sides things, including an onion rings, which was delicious. And we, me and the kids and Malka, we watched the Abraham Accords live from Washington, D.C. And that was... How should I say? It was definitely. I was so happy that it was a great moment for the kids to watch, and it was. I thought it was a great moment for the Jewish people, for Israel. I actually think I think that the Jews celebrated it more, but the real beneficiaries were the Arabs.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I have a lot of mixed feelings in about this whole situation, and that kind of touches on part of it, which is this is beautiful. Like there's something essentially bad about like countries finally making peace is a little bit of a stretch, since to say that we were in a state of war is a little exaggeration. But crossing the great divide, that's what I see to be the great benefit. Is like emperor has no clothes. We're not going to let this ridiculous counter narrative to Am Yisrael prevent us from the obvious. That's what drives me, the obvious benefits of linking up our future with the Jews, because when you look around the region and the 100-year war we've been fighting. We may occasionally have been on the ropes, but we are winning, people. Right. It's just not a question. If you look at the arc of it, in the Arab world, sadly, is in a mess in many places. And you know, even places like in the Gulf, where materially their society is succeeding, that's a success that needs to be cultivated and husbanded. Because the fact that they're sitting on the largest lake of oil and on the planet won't last forever in any number of ways. So I have like mixed feelings. It's more like, yo, thank you very much. like we were at war with you and now you recognize us. At the same time, I'm trying not to be the Grinch, because it's fundamentally a good thing. And what's really interesting is how far will this old world crumble? Right? Meaning, how much is this just like testing the waters, and then a good chunk of the rest of the Arab world is going to say, okay, listen, it's true, we want the Palestinians to have a good life, but we're not going to let them dictate our foreign policy or national interests any longer. And something I've seen you speaking about and a lot of other people's it's also, I mean, in terms of the Rosh Hashanah, people are lining up. Who wants to be in the book of life? Who wants to be in the book of death? Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, I don't, on some level, it's fairly obvious that you see a bunch of nominally pro-peace activists protesting this situation because it doesn't fit their narrative and it doesn't serve their personal interests, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, oh, I get it. You're just out for yourself, just like everybody else. Fine. Now we can treat you that way. There's a lot of illusions that are falling. And I think that's why it's essentially good. Although I have to admit, it's like a little bit of a grr around like we're at war with you. Like this is some great accomplishment that you finally accepted the reality.
You know, when you're in a fight with somebody, sometimes you deal with somebody who's in an irrational posture.
Yes.
But when that person is able to get their hands on themselves, you know, put themselves in control and to come down from the tree and overcome that hate and that tension, that anger, that simmering thing. That in itself is a big accomplishment. And I think that for the Arab world, this was the kind of opposite of Amalek, the cooling off of the hate. You know, it's like somebody had to step in, put the toes into that water and say, and very interesting. Here's a fascinating one. You just touched on it, which is they're now using the word sovereignty, which was a hot word here. They're using the word sovereignty in a different way, which is what you just said, which is they're saying the Emiratis, we're a sovereign nation. We want to make a relationship with another sovereign nation. We're not going to let the Palestinian issue be this thing that stops us from acting as though we've outsourced our foreign policy to you. Yeah. We're sovereign. And like, okay, so you got a problem with the Israelis. Well, whoop-de-doo. That doesn't make it an Arab problem.
That's the biggest piece. For sure it's the biggest piece. Hang on one second because I'm watching my battery descend even if we speak.
No worries. You plug in the meantime. We're about to come into Rosh Hashanah. And I was, one of the Ezra Mike Foyer plugs in. There he is. Plug in. Okay. As he's plugging in. That's right. You're feeling empowered. So just as we are facing this good new reality for a new year, which was the Abraham Accords and such a beautiful and apt name. I love that name so much. But at the same time, and everybody knows this, the great irony was there was Netanyahu. Now, Netanyahu, when things are going well for him, he's got this face on of being giddy. He's just giddy. You can just see he's just plain giddy. There's something about him. You know what? I actually respect that. I respect that it shines through that he thinks this is a great moment and a personal achievement for him and an achievement for the state of Israel. And
that's
an
important
giddy.
Point there is that personal achievement, which, you know, I've said some tough things about our prime minister on this show. So, you know, credit where credit is due is that this is the fulfillment of a posture that he has been pursuing for decades, which is that
that's right.
You make peace through strength. You don't make peace through concessions, not in this region, at least, maybe elsewhere, but probably not. But yeah, just, you know, you just make it so desirable to join us that it overwhelms all the other issues. Yeah. So, you know, got to give man credit.
I give him the credit. But at the same time, as he was sitting there in the dais, by the way, a marvelously cool day in Washington. A lot of people mentioned that to me, that it was in the low 70s in September, early middle September in Washington. That's not a simple thing because it's usually in the 90s and muggy. But in any case, it was a beautiful day. There was what many in the Jewish sphere got excited about is the mincha, afternoon prayer that took place on the south lawn there, and there was a lot of people joining that. That prayer.
It was cool.
And a lot of people also said, like, you know, let us have such a prayer on the Temple Mount of Jews praying. You saw Jews praying in front of this beautiful building. If you wanted to, you could transpose that to seeing Jews praying in front of the Temple Mount, in front of the temple. But, and this is the other side of that coin, while Netanyahu was giddy yesterday on the one hand, you know that he was on a plane that very same night to go back to the Holy Land, to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel, state of Israel, to face a very angry populace because of this COVID that is seemingly running amok.
5,500 cases in the last 24 hours.
Right. And closures.
We're at this point at the curve.
Right. And with a looming closure for the high holiday season, one of the biggest economic seasons, one of the biggest spiritual seasons. And so, like, you know, like, and I want to tell you, Rav Mike, I was not so far away from where you are right now at the Pardes Institute. I was in Talpiot in Jerusalem, and I was speaking to shop owners, and there's no way to deny it. They are PO'd. Oh, wow. I mean, they are.
Yeah, there's rage. It's a rage. And you know, it's justified, I have to say, because all summer long we were poo-pooing this situation. The cops weren't enforcing the rules. People were out and about as if nothing were wrong. The government was watching the numbers. It's math, people. It's math. And then all of a sudden, right before Rosh Hashanah, he's going to slam it down. Again, I'm not like I like people say, well, what should they do? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But the reality is it's a bitter pill. I cannot deny it. Yeah. Although I do have to say there's a tremendous spiritual opportunity. I think a lot about Shimshon Raphael Hirsch has a famous statement in one of his writings, which has gotten a lot of, not a lot, in the world in which I live, has gotten a lot of attention in the last 6 months. He was struggling with the birth of the reform movement in Germany. Are you familiar with what I'm speaking about? And a lot of the struggle in Germany, because of the nature of the political position of Judaism as an official religion, was around who controlled the schools. Right? And that was like this sort of field of battle. So he famously said that if he could just shut the doors of every shul in Germany for 100 years and force Judaism back into the home, which is its sort of natural, rooted environment, all these questions would work themselves out. But, you know, his sense was, and now I'm extrapolating, is that the politics and the public nature and the money and power was really poisoning the interaction amongst Jews. So there's an opportunity in being forced back into our homes at this, which is really the height of the spiritual season, to try to really root ourselves in like, wait a minute. What am I doing? What is the nature of my relationship to God, to humanity, to my family? I don't want to say going through the motions in a dismissive way, but aside from doing the thing, even in a deep, profound way, together with everyone else, now it's me and God. And yeah, please God, we'll get to hear the shofar. And of course, Bukod is always at home. But there's an incredible opportunity to strip away everything which is not a genuine expression of our relationship with God and to build from there. And like it or not, we're being given this opportunity. So might as well take up the gauntlet.
So Simon Zelkin writes, maybe this is a message from Hashem testing our resilience at such tough times, the most poignant time of the year, seeing how we deal with it. So I think that...
I mean, the message is tough because the message already forces me to want to say what's the content. The word that speaks to me is it's an invitation. It's an invitation. And that way, I can do with it as I will. I mean, I don't think we're really saying, Simon, but there's no question that, this was just kind of a little bit obvious.
So for me, last year, I was in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem. By the way, we're getting a little pixelation on you right now. So I don't know if you're like in a bad connectivity for a second. So Rav Mike, if you have a chance to strengthen that. Yeah, no, you're getting Max Hedrum-ish a little bit. In any case, last year for me was one of the highest Rosh Hashanahs of my life because I was in the Mount of Olives, and both mornings of Rosh Hashanah, I went up to the Temple Mount. And there on the Temple Mount, there were young Jews who are not allowed to carry any kind of prayer book up to the Temple Mount. They prayed the whole Rosh Hashanah prayer up on the Temple Mount. I'm talking about everything from memory, including the special prayers of Rosh Hashanah, and then the Torah reading and the Haftorah reading all by heart.
Wow.
I could not believe it. And to remind people, the first day's Torah reading is about the conception of and then the birth of Isaac, while the second day is about the binding and the binding which took place on the Temple Mount.
You were on location.
Right. I was on location listening to a reading about – now, for me, this happens like on Parshat Chayei Sarah when we read about Abraham's purchase of the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs, the Machpelah. That's amazing. But like to be on the Temple Mount on Rosh Hashanah in the morning and to hear the binding of Isaac where it happened right there, I mean that is a mind blowing experience. This year, I cannot go to Yerushalayim. It's like locked out a little bit, and so therefore it's really not the same. And so I'm being, as in your language, Rev Mike Foyer, I'm being invited in for a different kind of experience, but there's a part of me that's a little bit concerned. Will I be able to hit that high? will I be able to find that place?
You know, it's an important question, and it opens up like a larger discussion on how far we want to go with it into what spiritual practice really looks like. That one of the great challenges of intense spiritual experiences is that they overshadow the sort of more subtle texture of the spiritual life. Like you have these sort of high moments in there, and they can be transformative and illuminating, but often they rob us of the ability to access what's available to us in a daily basis and an annual basis, and we end up with judgments and feelings of failure, et cetera. Like it happens for me sometimes around Yom Kippur. I've had certain Yom Kippur that I come back to the house and I'm like dancing with the kids and like I don't even need to eat, and you know, shamayim. Others, it's like I made it. I wasn't so focused, and you know, is it? But the reality is that. All of these things are opportunities to meet God. Don't wait to do the work. You can always do the work. The question is that can we sensitize ourselves to the texture of spiritual experience? You know, because, you know, I'll give you an example. Your discussions with those shopkeepers, you know, has a tremendous opportunity to give them support, nechama, not because you're able to help them, because you care and because you're listening. And I had a conversation with somebody. I ordered some coffee from the Power Coffee Works. By the way, if you're in Jerusalem or in Israel at all, and you want the best coffee in all Jerusalem, you got to get it from Power Coffee Works in the Shuk. They're delivering. They will grind and ship it right to your door everywhere in Israel. And who could get it through the Chagim under lockdown?
But yeah, can I just tell you something, though, guys? Being on the Temple Mount and looking at the place of the temple, and remembering what Abraham, how he almost sacrificed his son Isaac, was an incredible moment. Yes, I see you, Rav Mike. You're back.
Did that help?
Yeah. Oh, you bet it helped. Yeah.
It's
a lesson for us that sometimes I heard this quote, like 98% of machines will be fine if you give them a restart, right? It's like
– And people as well, by the way.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So that's exactly what you were saying. Like there's an invitation. There's some kind of – there's the Hebrew word is itchul, like you la'atchil me'atchala, like to start again. It's a restart, itchul. So that's what you needed just now. So you're back. So you were talking about the folks at Power Coffee Works sporting that steampunk theme, and they do make good coffee there in the shuk there. And you're saying that the guy there was like, you know, it's so good to have a human conversation.
Yeah. I mean, listen, the business owners in Israel today, especially those who are immigrants, are really struggling, not just with the economics, but bureaucracy. That's what he's saying. He's like, I just don't know. I could be in contact with the area, with the police, and every day it's something new. And I actually do believe that everyone means well. I'm not a conspiracy theorist in the sense that I think that like people are out to get like the little guy, et cetera. There's always, you know, Rishayim in the mix, but I don't think that that's what's happening overall. But there is something inhuman about the large-scale approach. We're dealing with a large-scale problem, but there's something inhuman about it. And so the only way that people like you and I can overcome that is being more human.
Mm-hmm.
Being more human in the sense of being created in the divine and caring and knowing that, you know, that the most pure act of chesed, of loving kindness you can do is to give your time and attention to someone. Never forget that. It's something that you can always do, which is the highest form of chesed. Giving your time and attention to someone who needs it.
Now, I want to go back to the Abraham Accords for just a second and ask you something that I truly don't know the answer to and bothers me every year. But because it happens on Rosh Hashanah, I never remember to ask it later on, but I remembered it today, which is there is an inordinate amount of Ishmael in the readings, Hagar and Ishmael.
Yes.
And with respect, I would have maybe not, you know, included that whole segment in, and I'm always like, why am I reading so much about Hagar and Ishmael on Rosh Hashanah? It's like, are they, to use modern language, are they the other that I'm supposed to be concerned about? Is it about Abraham's heart and what's important to him? You know, it's like it's clear that the message is Isaac is born after many prayers. The prayer is received on Rosh Hashanah. He's born on Rosh Hashanah, or conceived of Rosh Hashanah. God hears the prayers on Rosh Hashanah. Isaac is born, and then he's going to survive the binding, and he's the next Jew. Why do you, like, is it like, remember that show, remember that movie Twins? Is that what this is about? Like, there's like, remember with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito?
Yeah.
It's like, why are you telling me that there's this other Ishmael story? Like, and the Ishmael story, it's important to state if people don't know what I'm talking about. The Ishmael story is about the pain that Abraham feels about, what's that?
It's not pretty.
Right. It's not so pretty. And it's also, what I wanted to say is it's clear that G-D, God himself, is involved and concerned with the survival of Ishmael.
Yeah.
Okay. And Hagar says, hey, what do you know what I mean? What am I, not a follower of the, of Abraham and his God? Of course I am. So there's like a lot of that in Rosh Hashanah, and always throws me off. Why did the Masoretes include this reading on Rosh Hashanah, do you think?
So I think you already named a couple of reasons that, to go back to your original point about the tension in Rosh Hashanah between the particular and the universal, I think it's important to remember that Hagar represents that side of Abraham. Hagar and Ishmael represent that universal side, even though in the end of the day, we're pursuing our story, and our story is a central story to the whole creation. Nevertheless, it doesn't exist on its own. I think that's one piece which is important to remember. Number two, Ishmael represents a certain aspect of judgment. You know, when God says, "Vaasher hu sham," that God sees him where he's at, that is the definition of judgment. You know, like one of the important things to remember in this season is the difference between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is Rosh Hashanah is about the snapshot of your life. Just show it to me. What have you actually done? Don't tell me about what came before, what came after, no extenuating circumstances or contingencies. That's the mercy of Yom Kippur. And so the harshness of the judgment, which comes with, well, Yitzhak is the future, and therefore Ishmael is out, right? And he's nevertheless judged for life. So there's a complexity in that deserves reflection in ourselves. And I would say last, but certainly not least, one also has to recognize that every judgment is a cutting. Right? If I say this is right, that it implies that that's wrong. If I say I'm going this way, that means that not that way. Choices exclude, judgments cut, right? And that it's going to require healing. And it's not for naught that whether you think that the Arabs of today are actually the descendants of Ishmael or whether conceptually they've been, it doesn't really matter. Look at the Abraham Accords. I think it expresses it perfectly. That's how we relate to each other. And it's not for naught that healing has begun to come. And let's remember, by the way, that healing will precede our problem with Esau. We have the tendency to think that, like, it's all hunky-dory because there's somebody in the White House who's backing our horse right now. But Alum Oshim B'Hartzion, the support of Esau, right? The Redeemers are going to go stand up on Mount Zion to judge Esau, because that's where the real break is going to lie.
It's funny you say that, because I think that, you know, I'm not so into the various conspiracy theories, and I'm not so into the various, you know, Gog and Magog type thinkers or messianic type thinkers. That's just not my thing. But I think that I always laugh that Esav in the Torah is called Edom. He's called red. And then he later on becomes the representative of Greece and of Rome, especially. There has never been a redder person than President Donald Trump. He is the reddest red
person. Himself.
it's like this, and he wears these red ties.
Yeah.
He's the reddest red person I've ever seen. Like, his whole complexion and everything about him just says red to me. Now, I'm colorblind, so I like, you know, certain colors, and red, by the way, is the one color I don't see so well. That's the nodes that
red, green,
right,
yeah.
Right. So, but like, that guy's red. You know what I mean? I can see that. And I'll never look at him the same again. Right. And to see this, like, this, shall we say, a Savian descendant, being clearly warm to Israel, warm to Prime Minister Netanyahu. Like, you can make fun of President Trump as much as you want, but at the end of the day, he is the leader of America, which is...
I'm not into making fun of leaders. I'm into criticizing. I'm into disagreeing with. I think that this make fun of leaders, the mockery,
right,
people don't understand. You're undermining leadership itself when you
do. Right.
And that's
right.
Dangerous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We're suffering from that right now.
Yeah.
This sense that it's just okay to mock your leaders and to burn them in effigy or to show pictures of them in inappropriate ways. Folks, you're not going to be happy with the world you end up in when you undermine leadership itself.
Well, let me just go back to what you said a minute ago about judgment being a cutting. One of the names of Rosh Hashanah is the day of cutting, Yom HaNesira, which is it's where Adam and Chava, according to one version, were a fused creature.
Back to back.
Back to back. And then God kind of split them up, which is, on the one hand, great, because now you could face each other. But on the other hand, it also means that you're no longer conjoined, and therefore you're always apart. Even when you come together, it's for a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. And so there's an element of that. And that also harkens back to Ishmael and Isaac, who were, you know, grew up together, but had to be separated for their own goods, but then came together to bury their joint father Abraham in Hebron. And so, like, there's something about, like, Rosh Hashanah, which is judgment, which cuts apart, which judges good and bad, which separates us. But at the same time, is there also a place where, like, we get to face each other and come together on this day like we weren't able to before?
I would say that that's Yom Kippur. I mean, I have to remember that the dynamic which is happening is one process. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and we might even really say Sukkot. I mean, you know, but there's a process of Nesira and Dvekut is the what you're speaking about. Is that the separateness allows for, as you
cleaving.
Said, a face-to-face relationship, which is a chosen cleaving, which is why if you look in the text of Genesis, that it says, you know, after the splitting of Adam and Chava into two people, or in, you know, the splitting of his side off in the text, that it says, "Alkem yazovish et aviv imo," so a man leaves his father and mother, "v'davak l'ishto v'hiu l'vasar echad," and cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh. So just think, that's exactly it's what it's described. It's they were one flesh, they're split apart, they become one flesh, but in a much more profound sense, because they can't stay that way. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you have to constantly choose. You have to constantly choose. And this is the nature of the relationship which God is offering us. Wake up. Recognize what you've done right and what you've done wrong. And choose life again. Choose life again. And then there's a healing that comes through Yom Kippur and Sukkot, and the intimacy returns and a sense of security. But there's a lot of Eima of the year, a lot of trembling and fear around Rosh Hashanah that you have to look your life in the face. You have to be willing to say, this is what I am. It may not be what I want to be, but I have to accept this is what I am, and I got here because of what I did. It is a time of radical responsibility. Interesting enough that on Yom Kippur is the opposite. It's a time of putting our responsibility on God. It's like, look, God, right here I am, I'm like an angel. If I didn't have to eat and I didn't have to sleep and I didn't engage in all the physical intimate relations, et cetera, I just wore white and stood in shul all day, look, I'm perfect, but you made me the way you made me. So, like, on Rosh Hashanah, I own it, but on Yom Kippur, you.
That's very interesting. That's a very interesting thought. Rosh Hashanah has awe, but it also has celebration.
Yeah.
Because it's, on the one hand, it's a day of judgment, but on the other day, it's a day of crowning. And how else would we have a coronation party if it wasn't with food? And for Malka, my wife, like, the simanim, the good signs that we make on the first night's meal, both nights' meal, where we take out all kinds of new fruits. We bless God for the new fruits. We bless God also for, like, we find witty ways to make these new signs. For example, we eat mushrooms. And as Shmuel Goldman once told me, may we have mushroom, you know, in the new year. We, you know, and you see that
Ooh,
he's
I'm
been
doing
blessed.
That one this year.
Huh?
I'm doing that one this year.
That's right. And there's other ones, you know, like having some pizza and saying that our enemies should lead potsets and other things that...
I like drinking beer and then calling for the rebuilding of the Ir HaBira.
Ir HaBira, very good. That's a good one. Bira, that's right. And there's many more. I even told Malka this year, I said, let's have cinnamon so that we should have good simanim. Okay?
Ooh, yeah,
I came up with that one. Yeah, I came up with that one this year. So that's really a fun time. And there's nothing like those... you know, there's a pageantry around it. There's a pageantry. The pageantry is oftentimes with also the fruits that come forth from the land, especially the pomegranate that comes forth at this time. And that's the pomegranate that also represents that the Jewish people are full of commandments. We're proud of having those 613 commandments. We're proud of we're thankful for having that yoke and that responsibility, and that's symbolized by that. And so there's this joyous pageantry around the new year that's coming. And so it's a big hodgepodge in some ways. It's like a day of judgment, a day of cutting, a day of seeing the other, but also a day of like, and that's the best part of Rosh Hashanah, usually cool air outside. You thank God for the whole kit and caboodle. And this year we're going to thank him also for being stuck on the inside and being invited to a new relationship.
That's right. Crowning God king, no matter where we are. That's mm-hmm. kind of what it comes down to, because God is king. God is king everywhere or nowhere on some level. You know, even though we as a people have struggled in our history to embody God's kingship in our national context, like we have the potential to do now, right? But we've learned is that as long as you're holding God's kingdom within, so to speak, that you have the ability to express it without, you know.
And your show, The Jewish Story, which is also found at jewishstory.co, and you also have a new website, which is
RavMike.com. RavMike.com,
just that simple. Yep. And you have a series right now that you kind of from your classes at parties, which is Heralds of Zion, and you've laid out so many rationales, various thinkers' apostrophe rationale, for a rebuilding of the Jewish state if the exile is unnatural. By the way, that's the one that that's the one tiny one that I disagree with. That's actually that? I have come to a different conclusion about the exile, is that it is a natural mode, a natural modality. That's the one, you know. And you mentioned in the name of the Maharal, somebody who
they take up the Maharal, yeah,
right. And like I would just say to him, I see what you're saying. Like I mean, you said we're more natural in the land of Israel, but the state of exile has a certain element of actually. It's part of what we do. Let's just put it that way. It's like it's just part of what we do, and there's a reason why we do it, and therefore it is a kind of natural state. But then there's so many rationales for being re-embodied in the land of Israel, and I find myself listening to your show and hearing different thinkers and thinking, that's true, and that's true, and that's true. You know, yes, it's, you know, national defense, and there's a problem solving element of getting us out of a place where we're being murdered. Yes, and we have to have our own culture and our own thing happening, because that's the birth of nations, and nations exist better on their land. Yes, and then at the same time, we got to, you know, build a temple and relive that biblical dream. Yep, you know, so like and when I listen to your show on this topic, I'm always struck by the enormity of the time that we're living in, the enormity of it. And the countermand to that enormity is the cynicism that I hear. It's like to me, it's like we do not even it is almost unpronounceable. When I say the word enormity, I feel like it's a small word to explain the enormity of what's happening here. And yet at the same time, I find that I sense that the media, et cetera, there's such a simplicity, superficiality, and a cynicism that is so not commensurate with the enormity of the moment. And that's something that I feel frustration with.
You know, on that note, I was looking at the way in which the New York Times covered the Abraham Accords. And it was just so obvious. It was so obvious that they can't ignore it, because it's actually in news. And they're aware that it's a big shift, but if you looked, I didn't even click on the articles. If you look, they have like the, okay, you know, they're signing this accords, and then the, you know, President Trump, they don't even call it President, they just call him Trump, right? The, you know, says priests are breaking out, but analysts are skeptical. But it has always been, is it really such a big deal? Like, literally, it's like we must deflate. And part of that is obviously their sort of relentless war on the president. But the deeper element is what you're saying, which is that the enormity of these events does two things. It calls into question all the structures which preceded it. And never forget, the media in particular has a deep, deep investment. I'm talking literal investment, and also cultural, emotional investment in what preceded, right? And whereas you and I know that for the real revelation of God's intent, a lot of the world as we know it is going to have to go. doesn't have to be catastrophic, God forbid, but it's going to have to go, right? It may have gotten us this far, but it's not where we need to be. So that's one side. They're defending their interests. The other side is that the enormity of these events demand something of us. They demand something of us, and people don't want to act. People don't want to act, right? I mean, to me, that was what caused me to make Aliyah. When I really kind of began to be religious and learn Torah and learn about history and see what was going on, it just, to me, it was like, obvious. It was like, oh, I guess I got to go. Like, I guess I got to go. And I'm not trying to make people feel guilty, or I'm not going there. I'm just simply saying is that the enormity of the events demands something. Otherwise, you're going to be forced to dilute them. Because the reality is there's a truth in it. And, you know, the truth always demands a reaction. Hiding is also a reaction.
Right.
But the truth demands a reaction. And if you choose to hide and undermine that truth, that is also, you know, a way to react, although not one that I would encourage.
Okay, Rav Mike, let's just read two comments here. Here's my friend Jonathan Feldstein, who is an avid lover of a good drink, and he writes, shot of tequila with salt and lime so that the warmth of the good feeling of the tequila overcomes the sour taste of the salt and tartiness of the lime.
Yes, and then we'll say that the L'chaim will be, whatever doesn't kill you, whatever doesn't tequila you makes you stronger.
That's right. And I do love a good tequila, and Jonathan, we've talked for a long time about you inviting me over to have that tequila with you, and I'd love to pop by and have some. And a great tequila will do great. Tequila for me is like the people who don't have vodka in the freezer, so you can have tequila because it doesn't need the freezer. But I think within the words of Jonathan here are more deep. There's a bigger depth here than just tequila. I think there's tartness out there in the world. There's things that need to be overcome, but there's something so beautiful and profound right now. I think that's what we're talking about. Like, overcome the cynicism of that bitterness and see the beauty of this time. And Robert writes, he writes like this. This is an interesting thing Robert writes. He writes, Truah, which I think he means the blowing of the shofar.
Yeah, Yom Truah.
Yom Truah, which is another name of Rosh Hashanah. He writes, Truah is an ancient and long-forgotten celebration, which Israel was charged to observe forever. In the last days, the children will return to the old ways, and so we have. Truah is about shouting a joyful warning, as we say, Gilu Bira'ada, right? Joyful because for me, it is a celebration. I look forward to sharing it. Yet a warning for those who are missing the boat, the ark, and a plea not to wait until it is too late. Sharing is caring. Much love and light to you all on this life-sustaining and important day.
Amen. Beautiful.
Yeah. Some great folks out there that are connected to us. Rav Mike, I want people to be even more connected to you, which is easy enough if they check out jewishstory.co and your new website, which is ravmike.com. Easy enough. And I want folks to also get a chance to really connect this year with the stuff that makes you connected to the land of Israel. One of the easy ones is Tchelet. If you go to Tchelet.com, you get your own Tchelet, your true blue Jew. There it is. There it is. Woo. What a feeling. I'm wearing blue and white. There it is. It makes a humongous difference. It's your tassels. It's your graduation tassels, and they could be with blue. So if you write in coupon code Yisha, you get, I think, 5% off, but we're always working to make that more. But whatever, you know, 5% is money. But that's right. It's so you're getting a coupon to do an ancient biblical commandment. That's awesome. The folks at Hebron Fund are absolutely key. If you believe that it's important to protect the forefathers and mothers who are buried in Hebron and to beautify that site. In fact, Rav Mike, right after this call, if I can have another 5 minutes with you, 4 minutes to talk to you about something related to how we promote the forefathers and mothers, something that you and I talked about in the past but have to re-talk about again. And also, how about going to download your application for Aliyah at nbn.org.il, Nefesh B'Nefesh, an amazing organization, which is gonna, you know, after the corona period, some predictions say are gonna get their money's worth because there's a lot of people who are interested in coming to the land of.
Hang on, there he is.
Were you stalling for me?
You will never know what I said. Well, I mean, this is being recorded, so
I can listen to it on replay. Yeah. But yeah, I pressed the button there. I guess I was looking for the other sponsor for the show, which is IsraelWines.org. Israelwines.com. I couldn't find the banner, and I must have pressed the button. So get your own Israeli wine through Israelwines.org. .com. Excuse me, Israel. Where is that Israel Wines?
Yeah, I'll Google it for you, man.
Here it is. Israelwines.com. Coupon code Yishai. And get 10% off there. And so you can have wine. Maybe you can get it for Sukkot if you order now. And finally, I urge you to help me build Israel together by bringing amazing people like Rev Mike Foer and other people together at YishaiFleischer.com. And I want to wish you, Rev Mike, a wonderful Shana Tova. Thank you so much for another great year of helping me and other people through your many good works, including this show, but certainly not limited to it. And want to just bless you with a great year of Hatzlacha in health, in welfare, in child rearing, and in helping so many more people envision the redemption that is so deep and so true, and you are really flushing it out for so many people, and that making it real in the mind makes it real in reality. I really believe that.
Amen. Well, I want to give you right back the sweet and healthy year, a productive year, a year where all the ideas inside you take form outside of you, where that connection between mind, heart, and hand is fluid and smooth and powerful, and that you should keep broadcasting and touching all the people out there in the world that I know really look to you as a light and inspiration.
All right. Thank you very much, Rav Mike. Shana Tova, and we'll see you hopefully in the year 5781.
That's right. We'll get you guys on the other side.
I came up with the acronym for me. I was working on it. Tieshnat P-Elef.
Ooh, I like it.
It should be a year of 1,000-fold. Tieshnat P-Elef. That was my. Okay, Rav Mike. God bless you. Thank you very much. And Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.
All right, everybody, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. One more segment, and this is a good one if you want the ins and outs of what the Abraham Accords is really about. Matt Brodsky is one of the most influential people in American foreign policy community. He's on my show right before the signing of the Abraham Accords, and you'll get a real insider's view in what Washington is thinking about all this. So without further ado, here's Matt Brodsky.
Because I've got a golden ticket. It's ours, Charlie. I've got a golden sun up in the sky.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show here on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter as well, on Periscope, and also on the Land of Israel Network and the Yishai Fleischer Show. And very excited to be with you here on the eve of the Abraham Accords. And I'm here in beautiful Judea, and I didn't get the golden ticket. The golden ticket did not come to me in the mail. I'm a little bit jealous. And I know that at the last big event that was televised from Washington, which was the deal of the century, peace to prosperity announcement. Well, I looked at the room and I saw a lot of my friends. And one of my friends that I saw in that event was my good friend, Matthew R.J. Brodsky, who was sitting in the audience there. And therefore, I'm not surprised that he also has a golden ticket for tomorrow's event as well. Matthew Brodsky has over 2 decades of experience focusing on U.S. foreign policy and national security. He has briefed members of Congress, departments of state, departments of defense, and National Security Council on issues like Iran, Syria, and the Palestine-Israel problems. He's also briefed me over a food at a restaurant in Washington many times. Brodsky currently assists the National Security Council and the State Department on policy and communications strategy to promote the Trump administration's foreign policy agenda. In the past, he's been many things, including senior fellow at both the Security Studies Group and the Gold Institute for International Strategy. Brodsky has a proven track record of making an impact on policymaking community in Washington, and he joins us on the show. Matt, thanks so much for being with us.
I'm humbled, but pleasure to be with you again, Yishai.
All right. So now you're on my show today, but earlier you were actually answering questions for news outlets from the Emirates and from the GCC, and you were like booked all day with them. What were they so excited to ask you? What was on their minds as they're in Washington and they're getting to this. And maybe from their questions, we could get a little bit of a sense of their mindset.
Their mindset currently is extremely pro-deal. And I have to say, since I've been doing a lot of interviews with Emirati networks and just with Middle East networks in general, I do a lot of this with on behalf of the State Department or the White House peace team. So for well over 2 years, I have had a sense of where questions are going from. What, in other words, what the policy thinking is at the tops of the network. And I've even noticed when I bring up Israel and their role in pushing back a common enemy in Syria, for instance, over time, where that was one of those, I would say that I myself would be kind of excited about that. But there would kind of just be a little bit of, like, you know, silence to where we are today, which is literally it's a new day as far as the networks are concerned. Also, as far as the guests are concerned, who I'm, you know, sharing airtime with, the people that they are booking are extremely pro-normalization, are looking for what all of this brings. And when it comes to the Palestinian question, which incidentally was always what had to be asked next. That was every time, you know, before a week ago, every time anything like this was brought up, it's what about the Palestinian question? What about negotiation? Blah, blah, blah. Right now, it's all sunshine and roses, and we'll see where this, we'll see where it leads. And, you know, there needs to be a realistic solution. I've not heard as much quoting, for instance, of the Arab Peace Initiative from 2002, which says something quite specific, but is frankly outdated. That used to be the talking point. Anytime that there was anything involving normalization, peace process, whatever, everyone points back, if you're in the Middle East, to the, well, we came up with this. And that's all changed. If what I see in the news is any indication, they're really welcoming this. And I know from Emiratis that I speak with, they're actually very excited, not just obviously for what it does with Israel, but for what it does with the United States and all the attendant messages that said that it sends to all the right parties around the region.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's you know, I was going to hold off on the Palestinian question till later, but you brought it up. You know, you basically are saying that used to be the issue. Like whenever you talked about Arab-Israeli detente or a coming together or coalescing. It would always throw back to, well, what about this thorny issue? What about this thorny issue? How do we deal with this thorny issue? And one gets the sense, and I've written this on Twitter, and some you get some pushback. One gets the sense that this whole thing is about sidestepping the thorny issue. It's like, actually, let's not ask that question right now. Let's not deal with the Palestinian problem. Let's go around and talk about other things that do bring us together. And the things that bring us together are an interest in prosperity, an interest in common defense against Iran, and also maybe it's not going to be said anywhere, but a realization after 100 years of war with Israel from the Arab world, a realization by some parts of the Arab world that Israel's not going to be defeated. So if you can't beat them, join them and start to work ahead towards the things that will give us the things that we want, prosperity and defense, as opposed to endless and pointless war, which only retards our progress. So if anything, I get the sense that the Palestinian issue is specifically being sidelined so that we can actually get together on other issues that do bring us together. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I've actually learned over the course of 48 hours now in the run-up to this to downplay, just because even when I say it, and I'm used to having the immediate, like, well, yes, let's turn the discussion there. I say that, and I'm like, it's just left on the table with, you know, the other guest and the announcer. And so I'm like, well, I don't need to bring it up then if they're not going to bring it up. That is, look, that is a major part here. But notice on an even higher level, ideologically, how this dovetails with the Trump administration's thinking to begin with when it comes to nationalism, or in Arabic, wataniya, the very concept of the nation state, okay? This is something that if you look at Trump's policy since the beginning, he hates the UN, you know? Frankly, he doesn't have as much of a need for NATO in his mind, especially with what they've been doing to still stay with Iran when it comes to the nuclear agreement. The idea that nation states have their own interests, they should have their own borders and control the flow of immigration, etc., that they should not be held hostage to what the UN says, to what the ICC says if you're in the United States camp. Or in this case, when I brought this up, the of nationalism, this is something that they do latch onto when they understand the idea that, hey, wait a second. We've been trying, they've been trying to have Palestinians make peace. They're not making peace. And a lot of the Arab states are saying, look, I have my own interest. Why am I going to sit here and wait for Palestinian leaders who are living quite well and really have no incentive to engage in negotiations to begin with? Why am I waiting for them? Why do I need to have them veto what's in my interest? What's in my interest, if you're in the UAE or Bahrain, is I want better deals with the United States. I want security guarantees. I want to work with Israel because, obviously, Israel gets the most preferential treatment from the United States. So the more I can drape myself with what Israel is receiving, the better it is for my future and for my people. And the Palestinians, frankly, on a leadership level, could have played all of this different. And it's really, I hate to use the phrase because it's so overused, the never missing an opportunity to miss an opportunity. But here, it's not even like missing the opportunity, which of course it is, that we all know. It's that in every, it's like a choose your own adventure book, but like imagine giving it to someone, and yet every single time they come to like the question at the bottom of the page, they take the wrong choice. You know, it's time and time again. You could have done a number of things that would have resulted in, say, the Arab League summit a couple days ago, having a totally different tone and tenor to it, having it would have taken place as an emergency session, as the Palestinians wanted. Instead, they have this, and the leadership is shouting into the wind, and a lot of the Gulf countries and states are saying, "Whatever, you know, sorry."
Right. Some people just want to move ahead, and other people don't. And the Palestinians want to. And let's not use the word Palestinians because it's not really fair, because we're talking about Palestinian leadership as opposed to Palestinian people that I meet all the time that are jealous. They told me last Thursday night, I had a meeting with Palestinians from Hebron. They said, we're jealous of the UAE. We want to move ahead. We want to start normalizing relations. But there's these people who rule us, and they are corrupt, and they are into endless war. This is how they make their living. And they have no interest, as you said just now, they have no interest in quote-unquote, making peace. They just don't have an interest in progress and moving ahead. But we, the people, are suffering. And then that's why, in many ways, this UAE, Bahrain, Israel, Abraham Accords sheds a very bad light on the Palestinian leadership, and they're feeling it. They're feeling the heat. Okay, so, Matt, you have a golden ticket. You have a golden ticket to a special event. And you know, there's the cynical types. Maybe they're not cynical. Maybe I shouldn't prejudge. There's the types that say this is all about a Trump reelection. This is what this is about. This is the gift that Trump wanted to give the conservative, especially evangelical group, show them that he's moving ahead for Israel, with Israel, in lieu of sovereignty. This is a great gift to them right before elections. So that's, you know, one camp. Also, the here in Israel, that same thinking goes, Netanyahu's got all kinds of troubles. He's got court cases. He's got other things. He's got corona. Okay, let's give him something. In answer, the head of the Mossad issued a statement today saying, listen, this is a long, long process in the making. We've worked very, very hard to make this happen. This is not something that just comes You know, it didn't start last week. This is a process that he himself and Netanyahu have been engaged in for a long time. And yeah, okay, it's an election cycle for President Trump. Let's help him out. But it's certainly in our interest and in the Emirati's interest and the regional interest to move this ahead at this time. So how do you see Abraham Accords at this time? And are you excited for having that golden ticket tomorrow?
First, I'm very excited to have the ticket. To answer your other question, no interview I've done on this topic, no matter what the network, can resist asking precisely that. Is this just to boost Trump's chances and to shore up his base and that? Look, the reality is this. Yes, this has been worked on for a long period of time, but we have to recall Jared Kushner, Jason Greenblatt at the time, what they wanted to do was put the peace plan out well over a year and a half ago. What ended up happening were three Israeli elections that froze the process, at least for the Americans to release it, and then the pandemic since March. So soon, none of that could get squared away. The fact is, the Trump administration's idea was to have this all done and this normalization process, which is supposed to accompany it, the peace process, whether or not Palestinians engaged or not, or the leadership did. This was all supposed to happen beforehand. Now, the fact is they made a lot of progress. I can't say whether or not it entered into their head that, well, if Biden wins, then they're going to try to reverse everything because Biden is pretty much pledged to what I see as a incredibly defunct and backward view of foreign policy. So if you're the White House, you decide maybe you put it out anyways. But this isn't one of those things where, you know, the president is sitting around and he's like, someone make that happen. And then they just cobbled this together. I mean, you don't get Arab states to cobble things together. You know, the Middle East is more like Treant or Treebeard from The Lord of the Rings. And let's not be hasty all the time.
And you're right that something like this doesn't come together easily. I mean, one of the most shocking aspects of this deal or accord has been that little like caveat thing, which is the flyovers over Saudi Arabia. It's like Israel's going to fly over Saudi Arabia. That's been like a taboo thing. And our airplanes have had to fly in crazy ways. Let's say, for example, to India, you know, down the Red Sea and around like this and just, you know, in crazy paths. And very quietly, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, says, yeah, it's okay. I can have blue and white fly over Mecca. It's cool. I can deal with that. And to me, that was like, whoa. Like, that was one of the biggest signals. The other one was also the meeting of the Arab League that you mentioned. And I think that what they're saying is, you know, yeah, I like how you put it from an American perspective. From your side, the way you see it is, we want more of America's favors. That's interesting. And, you know, from my perspective, it's like we want regional trade. We want Israeli defense as maybe a defense contractor for the United States regionally. We want more normalization around here, more tourism, more medicine, more access to all that kind of stuff. And we need defense from Iran. But tell me about that moment. Like, what are you thinking and what are you hearing about the Saudi question, which is really one of the leaders of the Arab world, more than the Emiratis and the others, you know, the Saudis. Wow, that's Saudi Arabia. That's like the essential Arabs. And somehow they're winking or nodding, saying we're part of this thing.
Right. So you don't get Bahrain specifically, but also to an extent the Emiratis to go along with this without the blessing of Saudi Arabia. Which is also diplomatically smart if you're Saudi Arabia, which frankly has internal issues that are different than the, you know, much smaller Emiratis and Bahrain. So it's good that they are going along this path. I imagine as the, you know, custodian of the two holy mosques in Mecca, the symbolism of them literally making this kind of deal is a bit of a bridge too far at the moment. I think everything is lining up in that direction when it happens. We'll see. I quote Bernard Lewis when it comes to predicting the future, and he always says that, you know, it's hard enough to predict the past. So I can't say when I think that this is going to happen, but it strikes me that of the Gulf Cooperation Council camp, that is Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the Emiratis, also you're talking Sunni powers such as Egypt, Jordan to an extent, and other Gulf countries, specifically not Qatar and not Turkey. I imagine that you would have Saudi Arabia be the last of those countries while everyone else goes first, kind of like the, the king or whatever, and you're going to allow everyone else to go test the water first before they get in. Plus, when they do that, it is it's the largest symbolic thing, which, again, I understand for a lot of Israelis, they think, oh, okay, good. You notice that we exist and you're allowing us to fly over. You know, to an extent, it's like you've recognized gravity. It exists whether you've recognized it or not, but whatever. Thank you. I understand that. But still, the way the region works, this is actually a big deal. And obviously, it's great for Israel and cutting down travel time.
No, I don't want to give the perception, give over that Israelis don't think that the Saudi thing is a big deal. I thought of it the opposite. I thought that was exactly that. It was a signal of large proportions saying it's a wink and a nod. It says, you know, we stand with this thing, and that's how it felt like. And you know, we've already known that Mohammed bin Salman symbolizes a modernization of Saudi Arabia, you know what I mean. To me, you know, El Al flying over Saudi Arabia is like that's a pretty big deal, not a small deal.
It's not only a big deal, but also maintaining. Allowing Saudi Arabia to come to this conclusion on its own, weighing out what it knows are its internal dynamics, is extremely important. A, the United States has demonstrated time and again that we're just pretty bad when it comes to knowing all the internal dynamics inside of countries. And, you know, we've had grand ideas of we'll take this guy, we'll take him away, and everything will be fine. We've learned the hard way that that's not the way it is. So we have an ally who has a reform plan in Saudi Arabia with MBS, and they are going to go about this at their own pace, 2030. The other important aspect is that making sure that they do this at the right pace is huge, because if you step back and you look at what has been called the global war on terror, which obviously is a war on ideology, it's not a war on the tactic of bombings. It's to change the ideology. The only way that happens is when Islam deals with Islam. That's not something that Israel can do. It's not something the United States can do. And that is the more important meta issue, that by allowing Saudi Arabia to go in this direction and to welcome it, to frankly not slap its hand every chance that we have, as some in Washington certainly would like to do, that will pay the biggest dividends for, I think, all of Western civilization, frankly, the whole world in general.
You're saying big things right now. You're talking about a mind change within the Islamic civilization. And we're seeing that potential, certainly accepting Israel and aligning with America is very different than the jihadist / Soviet non-aligned alliance. That's a very different type of alliance for sure. And what you're also hinting at is that there needs to be Muslim or Islamic answers to be able to deal with Israel and other things, and to just really yearn to modernize and to come into the family of nations. Interestingly enough, I found actually a statement by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe said that the Arabs are going to come into a consciousness down the line where, like other industrialized nations, that they're going to realize that the cost of war is too much and it's retarding their progress, and that they're going to indeed want peace with Israel without Israeli concessions, because they're just going to realize that it's just in their self-interest. But you're saying also that there needs to come a kind of Islamic ideology around that. And I guess that leads me to the next question, which is, okay, we have, maybe it's not stated, but there's a new axis. It's the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, maybe a few other countries, the Moroccans, the Sudanese. We'll see what else. And, you know, the Saudis tacitly saying that they're on board with America and Israel. That's an alignment. That's an axis. But there's a different axis right now, which includes Iran, Qatar, Turkey, and then small groups, Iranian subgroups like Hamas, and then the Muslim Brotherhood. The subgroup of Hezbollah, and then Muslim Brotherhood of Hamas. So you have these, let's call them, for the sake of our conversation, recalcitrant forces, jihadist forces of various ilks, or I wouldn't call Turkey jihadist. I would call them neo-Ottoman, mm-hmm. right? So you have these old, you know, like the Turkish Empire, the Iranian, the Persian Empire trying to come back up again. And I don't know, like there's a sense, if people are paying attention to it, that there could be a war between Turkey and Greece over the Mediterranean issue, you know, that could strike. So these guys are feeling hot under the collar, seeing this new alignment with Arab and Muslim folks that used to be more on their side. So how do you think the bad guys are, from my perspective, you know? Well, let's put it this way. The guys on the other side of the line, should we call them bad guys or enemies, or maybe we should use softer terms? But the Qataris, the Iranians, the Turks, or the Erdogans, how are they feeling at this moment, do you think?
Well, I mean, look, Iran, of course, is easy. That's they're very unambiguous with where they stand and what they think. Then you have Qatar, which is supporting the Muslim Brotherhood throughout the region, kind of bankrolling Turkey, and has the most powerful or most watched news network in Al Jazeera. To an extent, they play all sides. On one hand, they did learn to step that up a lot during the Obama administration, because, of course, it was in fashion for the Obama administration to promote the Muslim Brotherhood, as he did with Mohamed Morsi in Egypt. And so this is it made sense for Qatar, which it is very much out of step with the current administration's view of the region. And then you have, which is more interesting to me somehow, is Turkey, which really doesn't offer much of anything. They rely on Qatar. So like that's the big brother in this scenario. And they're rejectionists. You know, they came out completely against the Abraham Accords. Oh, it's a horrible thing. And Erdogan cursing it. Never mind the fact that they actually have, on paper, normalized relations with Israel for a while, right? So they're actually accusing the UAE and Bahrain, like, how dare they do what we did a long time ago? So they're two-faced about it, frankly. And that's a different struggle. Yes, it's a neo-Ottoman thing that Erdogan is trying to recreate, and he's trying to basically compete with Russia and Iran and use them at the same time. And they do this in Libya and throughout Africa and other places. They're the ones that tend to cause headaches for us. And with Russia, I think one of the new things that the Trump administration learned, I guess, when it came in, was the idea that, hey, you know what? We don't actually need to solve everything. That's a new thinking. In the United States, for decades, you don't touch anything unless you are going to have the solution, and then you stay until you solve it. These people that we're talking about and dealing with, and again, like you say, whether you want to call them enemies, adversaries, frenemies, whatever, they're under no illusion that they need to solve things. From their perspective, they look at the United States, they see that we are the lead power, and what they need to do is take us down a few notches. They don't need to solve the problem in order to do that. So we don't actually, if we stop looking, as we have, at the idea that we must solve everything, it really is a bit liberating and allows us to focus on making deals that will set up the future for better deals. For incidentally, for a reason that's exactly as you described, that I heard today and yesterday, and I have a feeling I'll hear it tomorrow from Arab spokesmen. The idea of you talking about how life in reality is with Palestinians, which is totally different than the news media presented, or how Palestinians are jealous of, some of them are jealous of these kind of deals. The economy that's being focused on, that Kushner's plan was focusing on for everyday Palestinians, the things that the Emiratis, that other Arab spokesmen are now speaking about, is how this is the type of thing that will improve day-to-day relations, that will improve the day-to-day life for Palestinians, for Arabs, people who get up in the morning and it doesn't matter to them the latest decree from the leader. What matters more is, can they get to work? Do they have a job? Are they going to be able to put food on the table? That's the same anywhere, especially in the Middle East. This kind of moves things in that direction. And it's it was interesting because I actually thought of you as I heard them saying this, because I thought to myself, this is kind of what you've been saying. And in that regard, you take what seems or can be portrayed as a small deal here, but you create conditions, you create momentum, a train that is moving that is hard to roll back and unwind, or as other people call it, a fact on the ground. It becomes more of a habit, and that will lead to better things in the future, I think.
Right. I just want to give you an example, Matt, that my sister studies at the Weizmann Institute. Actually, she's doing her postdoc there, and she sent me a press release within the Weizmann Institute, which says the Weizmann Institute, which is one of the Middle East's leading scientific institute, if not the leading one, says it signs a memorandum of understanding with Mohammed bin Zayed University of Artificial Intelligence in the UAE. Like there's been no time wasted,
right,
in making deals, like real deals, like flight deals, university deals, like. It's as though there's been a tremendous pent-up hunger
right,
for progress and moving forward. And you know, I saw Jared Kushner being interviewed on the airplane when they were heading over to the UAE. So they're like, you know, the reporters asked him a question. So he goes, "Look, we're not politicians. We come from the business world. We're deal makers." And It's a great alternative language that has been brought into play, and it's very useful. And again, as I began, it sidesteps some of the thorny issues, the religious issues, the Palestinian issue, all that. It's just sidestepping it and coming to things that people really do want, and that's very powerful. Speaking of language, Abraham Accords. For me, this is a very important term. As the spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron, where Abraham is buried, the term Abraham is a very powerful term. And I wrote an article explaining that this term counteracts the term occupation. If the term occupation means that Israelis are foreigners in this region, the term Abraham means we're an ancient people together with the Arabs. There's something that brings us together. There's something that is joint. We have a joint father. And I just want to like give a real like shout out and thumbs up to the term Abraham Accords, which is to me, as a person concerned with language, is one of the big victories, along with the deals that we just talked about. Just the term itself is a great narrative victory. What do you think about that?
You're exactly right. And that's also something that I've seen media leaning into on the Arab side as well, saying that when it comes to justifying, look, we should be sharing the region. They have a long history. We each come from the same father. It's look, this is a normal thing. It's a natural thing. It gives a kind of a permission structure for them to discuss it. But it also, you know, as it turns out, happens to be the truth. So I think it was a great formulation as well.
I just for a second, I just want you to know that on this live broadcast, I'm broadcasting to Facebook, to YouTube, and to Twitter. On Twitter, there's an army of warriors that want to besmirch Israel. So this guy here, just to put it up on the screen, his name is Musty. What is it? Musty One. I read Musty Stone. That made more sense. He said, original Jews are brothers with Muslims, but New Order Jews are just Nazis. So you have out there.
Jews without ideas, the dumb Jews, you know, kind of like Europeans, like they have no problem commemorating the dead Jews. It's the ones that are alive they have more problems with.
Right. But what you're saying is that you've even seen Arab media talking about the Abraham Accords in the other way, which is, yes, let's recognize that. And that's part of also what we said before. What you said a minute ago, which we talked about, an Islamic ideology, just by using the terminology of Abraham about the Jews, that is putting in place an idea that the Jews are an Abrahamic people and that we can come together. By the way, for Jews who are also suspicious of Arabs, it reminds them of the famous story that it was Ishmael and Isaac, actually the Torah records it, the Bible records it as Isaac and Ishmael buried together their joint father in Hebron. They came together for this thing to honor their father. So even for Jews who are skeptical, the term Abraham is very useful to bring the Arabs into a better light, a better focus. I guess it goes without saying that some people in the world that I live in are concerned also with what was promised to be Israeli sovereignty originally by Netanyahu in three elections and has now been ostensibly frozen. And instead of the sovereignty, we're getting reports, unconfirmed reports by people from the Israeli left saying that Netanyahu has promised to freeze Israeli growth in the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, the so-called settlements. I'm talking about Jewish yearnings for our land, and which is from what I represent, I have to speak on that. Meaning to say, I'm not talking about Palestinian rights and Palestinian future and Palestinian negotiation and recalcitrance or not. I'm talking about what we yearn for, which is to be sovereign in the historic biblical heartland of the Jewish people. And I'm just saying, I'm talking to you as a representative of the administration. I'm just saying, hey, like with regarding to those guys and what their problem is, that's one issue. But I'm talking yearning for what we've wanted, what we've pushed for. And it turns out that wherever Israel has really managed to hold on to is where has been recognized, if it's the Golan Heights or Jerusalem or the recognition that Jewish presence in Judea and Samaria is not illegal under international law by the Pompeo Doctrine, Pompeo Declaration. Those have been great victories and very important ones. All right, we're talking and we're finishing up our conversation with Matthew Brodsky, who has over two decades of experience in U.S. foreign policy and national security, especially about the Middle East. He's briefed everybody and many times in Washington. I catch him on the way to the White House or on other important places, including the National Security Council, the State Department, where he currently assists on policy and communications strategy to promote the Trump administration's foreign policy agenda. And along with many very important articles and a great Twitter feed as well. Matt, I just want to tell you again that I feel that you are lucky to be amongst the folks that are going to be on the White House lawn tomorrow. And I hear that the weather is good. Is that right?
Yeah, it's unbelievable because August is known in D.C. as just swamp humidity. Today was in the mid-70s, around 20 Celsius. It's going to be the same tomorrow. Sunny, but not horrible. This is going to be a South Lawn experience in the White House. Yeah, I mean, you could have had something where everyone's dressed up in a suit and the shits is just pouring.
So listen, have a great time at the Abraham Accords. And please remember that we're sending you blessings from the tomb of Abraham and the forefathers and mothers in Hebron. And please send our regards and say hi to all the friends. We'll be watching you on TV here from Israel, and I'll be sure to look out for you again. Maybe I'll take a picture of you so you'll see how you look on Israeli TV. This is a big day, and please, I'm comfortable telling you that even amongst the so-called settlers, and certainly on Twitter all over the place, I see a lot of excitement and hope for this. And that's great because this world is right now has a lot of divisiveness and corona and other issues that are striking at people. And this Abraham Accords is really a sign of hopefulness. And I hope that it's going to be blessed tomorrow. Matt, thanks so much for being with us. Have a great time.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you again.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us, Matt. And thank you, folks, for being with me here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. How much fun are we having by talking about the issues that matter so much to the Middle East and to the future? And if you're on my side, not everybody is, let's send blessings to Washington and to leaders. Instead of cursing leaders, which is what the media does so often, let's try hard to actually send blessings to leaders and really pray. Hey, did you think about taking just a few minutes today and putting in a good prayer that tomorrow will go well and that will mean the beginnings of new tidings for this region and for the children of Abraham? And with that, I want to wish you a shalom and blessings for a Shana Tova, happy new Jewish year, which is indeed important for all those people who believe and have a part in the God of Israel. So Shana Tova to all of you. Have a happy new year. Write me an email, yishai@yishaifleischer.com. Check out yishaifleischer.com for articles, videos, podcasts, and ways to connect. Looking forward to being with you more. Thanks so much, and blessings from the land of blessings. Shalom.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, and what a show it was. We had Malka Fleischer talking about Corona and Rosh Hashanah and recipes. We had the inside spirituality and meaning of Rosh Hashanah and what the liturgy is all about and how to connect and to find the invitation towards a service this year. And finally, Matt Brodsky on the inside track of what the UAE, Bahrain, Israel, and America quadrilateral Abraham Accords is really all about. So lots of good stuff for you. And I want to wish you blessings from the land of blessings. Please check out our sponsors, Hebron Fund, hebronfund.org, Tchelet, T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T, Israel Wines, israelwines.com, and all our friends out there like Nefesh B'Nefesh, and also Jewish Legos that you could check out at jbrick.com. All of our friends out there that are doing great things. Check out, of course, the Land of Israel Network, thelandofisrael.com, and help support this show by visiting yishaifleischer.com/donate. Help me keep the show getting out there to the world for free and getting out strong. Thank you very much to Moshe Herman, to Ben Bresky, and to Tabitha for helping so much to get the show to you. And lots of blessings to you personally. Thank you so much for all your emails and all the love for this year. Tufshin Pei, 5780 was a great year in many ways. 5781 is going to be even better. Tieshna PLF. I can't wait to hear from you. Yishai@yishaifleischer.com or yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And blessings from the land of blessings wherever you are. Lots and lots and lots of love. May God's face shine upon you. May he bring you closer. May we serve him well. And may we always be together. Shalom.
Shalom, everybody. This is Jeremy Gimpel from the Land of Israel Network, but also from the Land of Israel Fellowship. Today, Ari and I and Tehila Gimpel are preparing for the biblical feasts. We have members from 31 countries joining us every week, Sunday, live at 6 p.m. For those that can't make it live, they get a direct recording sent to them. We're growing together, we're learning together, we're celebrating together. The gates are open for all who want to come and join. And so this is a personal invitation to all the listeners out there. If you want to join the Land of Israel Fellowship, just go to thelandofisrael.com/fellowship. And you can join us tomorrow as we prepare for the big days ahead.